Coming up today, the care.data saga continues in light of some new revelations about how our patient data has already been used. A team at MIT has developed a pee stick test for cancer, while over at Harvard, some little rascal has been using a supercomputer to mine Dogecoin. We'll also talk about an amputee who has had his first pain-free night in 48 years thanks to augmented reality, and we'll have a roundup of the news and opinion juice from Mobile World Congress. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to pee sticks and difficult to pronounce cryptocurrencies. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Liat Clark.
And I'm Nicholas Tufnell.
Well, this is new again, a new team. And that is because Nate and Katie are both in Barcelona covering Mobile World Congress. So they are actually creating a separate podcast, which by the time you're listening to this should be available, that will be just a half an hour dedicated to all the tech launches coming out from that. So definitely watch out for that in your podcast feed. However, we are going to be discussing the regular news. We will have a report from Nate, a little snippet, so you'll get the highlights. But if you want a more kind of comprehensive analysis of Mobile World Congress, go and check out our podcast special. So let's get on with the news. The first piece of news is that the care.data saga continues. Now, we have spoken about this in a couple of podcasts already, so if you're bored of it already, I apologise, but it's getting more and more outrageous. So if you don't know what care.data is, it's a medical sharing scheme that involves extracting patient data from GPs' databases and storing them centrally with something called the Health and Social Care Information Centre. Patients' GP data will then be connected with all the data relating to their hospital visits and social care to try and give a rich view of how patients interact with the NHS. Now, as we've said before, this is potentially massively useful for researchers, but there are lots of concerns about who will have access to that data. It's essentially a full medical history, if you take out things like free text notes, of everyone in England. And in our research, we found that lots of people are concerned about this. And one of the greatest concerns is that the data will be given to insurance companies and that this might be used to influence premiums. And care.data, the NHS actually, you know, told us that this would be an illegal use of care.data if it did happen. Care.data is exclusively about, you know, finding benefits for the NHS, and they will not, you know, sell it on to companies for this sort of use, or won't approve it, approve use of the data in this way. Well, it turns out that actually the health service has already handed over 13 years worth of data relating to 47 million patients, it's data from hospital records, to a professional body for actuaries.
Surely they should be jailed.
Well, the thing is, I mean, many people probably don't know what an actuary is, but they assess risk in order to help insurance companies price their premiums. So, and they took this data, it was a professional body. They've contacted us to express that they are not a trade body, they're a professional body, but they're not for profit. But semantics aside, in my opinion, the data was combined with credit ratings to come up with new pricing models, or sorry, they call it more accurate pricing models. And then this information has been disseminated with their members, who are actuaries, and actuaries work with insurers to determine premium pricing. So we feel as though that is tantamount to sharing the data with insurers. And I think most people listening would agree. Please do contact us if you don't agree. But worse than that is that this episode led to some quite vehement questioning by a parliamentary committee who were probing the NHS to find out who else has had access to this data. And the response was just completely unsatisfactory. They said that the data that went to the actuaries, or the actuary trade, professional body, was released by the data center's predecessor. It's called the Information Center. Now, the Information Center was kind of rebranded, slightly rejigged, as the Health and Social Care Information Center, which is now responsible for the new care.data program. But they said that because this had happened, the Information Center no longer exists. And so they can't promise to be able to tell us who accessed it in the past.
They make it sound like there was a targeted nuclear disaster just at the information center. No records, no people, nobody knows.
Yeah, no one knows. And, you know, doesn't this sound a bit like sort of carrying out a crime and then changing your name by Deepole and then expecting, yeah, you know,
it wasn't
not
me
to face the consequences. Now, we have had a lot of feedback about this story. We asked for feedback before the podcast, but we'd already had quite a bit. And I want to read out some of it. We had contact from Big Brother Watch, who said, "This is not the end of the issue. We have significant ongoing concerns regarding the care.data scheme, both in terms of how patients have been told about what's happening and the long-term privacy implications of creating a new database and releasing data that could be used to re-identify patients." We also had Ollie Fig, who actually does work for us, he's one of our sub-editors, but said that the analogy, whereas I said changing your name by Deepole, he said it's like a company bankrupting itself and then starting business again the next day under different colours, but with the same personnel, all of whom are legally untouchable. But Deepole works too. And then finally, I wanted to say a comment from Roland Dunn, who emailed to say, "The whole project has a feel of the end justifies the means, which might be fine in an extreme situation, e.g. a war or a national health crisis, e.g. plague, but we don't have that. And this is our most intimate data. And we're being treated incredibly shabbily by the fact that it is opt out rather than opt in."
I would have thought, with the whole fact that they have proven to sell or at least give data to insurers for a processing fee, whatever it is they define it, just has completely destroyed any chance of this going through in its current form.
Well, I guess that remains to be seen. But as you know, we've reported before, it's been delayed for 6 months. So hopefully in that time, there'll be some major changes. Although Tim Kelsey, who heads up the programme in the parliamentary committee yesterday, said that they weren't going to change any of the way that it was extracted. They're only going to change how it's communicated.
How can they get away with that after saying to you it's legal and then 1 week later?
Well, it's because it was the previous organisation that did it. And also, they're not. They would probably say, because this is a charity, it isn't technically. The ridiculous thing is, they made the report. They call themselves a non-profit body. They give it to their profit-making trade, members.
Yeah, it's just a middleman. The body is a middleman that gets it to the insurer. So it's a way of getting.
It's like
the
saying
law.
The MPAA isn't representative of Hollywood. It's ridiculous.
This is a big problem at the moment, I think, with putting data before people.
Yeah,
I think it's we're seeing it a lot in journalism, and now it's creeping into other areas of life. And I think it's really destructive because there are people behind all these numbers and all these figures, and it's always now the data that comes first because they're facts, and you can't say anything about facts.
And it's a business, so that's why they deal with it that way.
I would point out that the case which we talk about, the actuaries, they claim that the data was anonymised. But looking at the actual data sets that were given, it was considered what care.data describe as amber data, which could be re-identified. It's not your name. It's not your actual postcode, but it's your a unique identifier, which is just a kind of pseudonymisation process. Your age, the area you live in, the dates when you go into hospital for different procedures, what procedures you have, what diagnosis you get. And so if you know that someone went into hospital on day X for because they fell off their bike and broke their arm, that's going to limit the, and they were in London Bridge area, that's going to limit dramatically the number of people. But anyway, I think we talked about this for too long. If you have any more thoughts on this matter, please do email us podcast@wired.co.uk. This podcast seems to be quite health heavy. Liat, there is a pee stick test for cancer.
Yes. Well, so far it's been tested on mice.
Ah.
But the idea is that we will one day have a cancer test, something akin to how a pregnancy test works, although obviously delivering bad news.
Yes.
So it's not a very nice one. So this technology has been developed by a team at MIT, which was actually building up work already done in 2012. Back then, the test relied on sampling the urine using a mass spectrometer, though, which is obviously quite a bit more pricey than a piece of paper.
How much will a mass spectrometer set you back?
I did check on eBay, and there was one for a mere £79,999, but I believe that was a top-end one.
Oh, right.
But I don't know what kind they would need, but they can be pretty pricey. So the basic premise is, because tumours don't produce enough biomarkers to be detectable, we can create synthetic ones that interact with tumor proteins to signal the presence of those authentic biomarkers. You're basically kind of amplifying their presence. So in 2012, they developed this technique where they coated nanoparticles with peptides, and these peptides interact with particular proteins produced in large amounts by tumors called MMPs. The nanoparticles are injected into the subject, find their way to the tumor, and then those tumor MMPs typically, they basically work by helping cancer spread by cutting the body's own proteins and letting cancer cells just cause chaos. This is obviously a very, very broad generalization of how they work. When the peptides from the nanoparticles reach a tumor, the MMPs does the same thing and will snip them. And what happens is, as more and more are cut, they start accumulating in the kidneys and then expressed in urine. So in 2012, the way they would look in the urine for this was using a mass spectrometer, which, you know, does what it says on the tin. It works out the mass of different molecules, and then they can identify which peptides are being peed out.
I love the way you say that does what it says on the tin. That doesn't immediately obvious to most people that's how a mass spectrometer works.
In the title.
Yeah.
Okay. With the paper, though, they had to take a totally different approach. What they did was introduce antibodies that attract the peptides. So when you pee on the stick, any peptides in your urine are kind of captured by these antibodies. And then along the bit of paper, just like on a pregnancy test, there are lines, but these lines are made up of different antibodies, which react with different peptides, which have reacted with different proteins in the tumour.
Right.
If you follow.
Yes, I follow. So it can just say, bad luck,
yeah,
you've got...
Exactly. And the theory is, depending on which peptides you use in the initial injection, they'll interact with different tumours, and the markers will tell you which type of cancerous tumour is actually there. So far, we have identified colon cancer in mice, and also blood clots, which is actually a sign of cardiovascular disease. So the idea is it could be used for such a broad scope of things, if you've got the right peptides interacting and the right antibodies on the strip.
So what is this actually dependent on us kind of identifying in order to be able to cross-reference sort of certain types of cancers with the urine analysis?
It's the peptides.
So you have to identify the right peptides.
Yeah, exactly. So the peptides that will interact with specific tumor proteins.
Yes.
And if a peptide encounters that tumor protein, it will be snipped and end up in the urine.
Okay.
But if it doesn't, I think it's less likely to be detected.
But the problem is, there are so many different types of cancer that there must be so many different types of these peptides.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is like, they're obviously at the beginning of a giant mountain of research. But it's kind of similar to what Jack Andraka, he was using a nanoparticle coated strip of...
Nanotube,
carbon nanotube coated strip of paper, where antibodies would react with chemicals present. But it's obviously very early days, but they're kind of hypothesizing that they could use implants and in higher risk people who, you know, might be at chance of relapsing,
yeah,
to monitor them all the time.
That's fantastic. So at the moment, it's still in mice. Are we anywhere close? Is it about having more studies in mice, or are we at anywhere near a stage of being able to move those into sort of human trials?
I do not believe we are that near
human
trials. I mean, it will be, you know, done with human samples at some point, but
yeah,
not actually injecting it into people yet.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to having an update about that in the coming months, years, however long these things take. Probably years, actually, won't it?
Yeah.
The next story we're going to talk about is some little scallywag or scallywags who've been mining Dogecoins using a Harvard supercomputer.
Yeah,
Nicholas.
I think it's just a scallywag. And
the
so,
technical term.
Yeah. It's a researcher at Harvard University, and he's been basically using their supercomputer, which is actually a cluster of computers that makes sort of one big supercomputer. It's called Odyssey, and it has about 4,000 CPUs, so it's a bit of a beast. And he decided, instead of using it, you know, to sort of make groundbreaking discoveries in the fields of medicine and computer science.
Cancers.
Exactly. Instead of doing all that boring rubbish, he decided instead that he would use it to mine for Doge coins. I've hit you with that immediately. Yeah. And haven't even prepared you for it. We don't really know how to pronounce Doge coins, Doge coins, Doggy coins,
Doggy coins. Well, we've had this discussion before and I've settled on Doge. Liat settled on Doge. Yeah. Let's agree to disagree and move on.
I'm going to go with Doge, but just initially I was a Doge man.
Okay.
But now I'm going for Doge. So what is a Doge coin? Well, it's a small cryptocurrency based on the Doge meme, which was originally started as a joke, which is sort of a little dog, and he's got text around him that's sort of how one might imagine that dog would speak. it's very peculiar. Just Google Doge, Doge dog. And it's a bit like Bitcoin. And just like Bitcoin, you need to mine the currency in order to make any money. But also that requires a hell of a lot of processing power and patience. However, with a supercomputer that has thousands and thousands of CPUs, you can essentially mine the equivalent. I think it's 1 year on just one person's personal computer can be mined in about 8 hours on this Odyssey computer, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So he had it running for about a couple of days. Again, no one really knows. They're not really revealing much. And it said that he probably made hundreds of thousands of dollars from Doge coins, which is pretty impressive considering it started as a joke based on a meme, I think, on either 4chan or Reddit.
Yeah. And so is he kicked out of Harvard or just kicked out of Odyssey?
He was booted out of off the network, but I don't think they kicked him out of Harvard because I think he's probably worth hanging on to.
I'm sure they accepted some kind of donation.
Yeah, a Doge nation.
Very good.
Our final piece of news before we have a lovely little segment from Nate is a story that an amputee suffering from phantom limb pain has experienced his first pain-free night in 48 years because of augmented reality. Now, Liat, this is extraordinary.
I think this is pretty incredible. It's my favourite story of the month. Where are we at in the month? Yes, it is. Absolutely incredible. If you don't know much about phantom limb pain, don't worry. I don't think scientists actually understand it a great deal either, but it's very common in amputees. It's apparently affects around 70% of them. And there's a range of therapies you can try, like acupuncture, drugs, or mirror therapy, where you literally hold up the limb against a mirror and, you know, try and trick the brain into thinking for a while that there's another limb there, and it kind of alleviates it temporarily.
That's incredible. And that actually works as well.
I think for some people, obviously it's not going to work for everyone, but they've also transferred that kind of therapy into virtual reality. But this is a massive step up from that, from a guy called Max Ortiz Catalan from the Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg. Now, he is a very cool guy. He's been working with myoelectric prostheses for several years now, which are basically automated limbs that use electrical signals remaining from the remaining nerves to function. So basically a wearer of one of these limbs has to learn to think about moving their arm again and can actually control the movement of this prosthetic. And he's actually pioneering this new properly implanted into the bone prosthetic, which is going to be revealed apparently in a few weeks or months. So anyway, he's taken these principles and transferred it to phantom limb therapy. So instead of adding a prosthetic on, what he's doing is hooking up the electrodes externally onto the site of the amputation. So he actually suffered an injury 48 years ago and was amputated from the elbow down onto the lower limb. So kind of just around where the elbow was, there, that's where the electrodes are attached.
On one arm?
On one arm, yes. And the way the electrodes are positioned, he can now experience or kind of produce on screen 8 different ranges of motion. And one is, you know, flexing the elbow, flexing the wrist, turning the wrist, things like that. And he has been using this now to control a racing car on screen. And I've watched him and he's amazing. He just controls it perfectly. I don't know about you, but I am always smashing into walls. It's quite embarrassing.
Real car or?
No, I don't drive.
Well, that's why.
But, yeah.
So hang on. He's at a screen with his amputated limb hooked up to some sensors and he's kind of thinking about moving his arm, and on screen he can see the arm moving in the way that it would be moving
exactly
otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, 8 different ranges of motion, it's not going to be perfect, but I mean, from what I've seen online, it's pretty bloody good. Yeah.
So if he can move his arm like that when he's all hooked up and he can see it, how does his arm feel when he can't see it?
Well, I think people don't feel like they feel pain. So instead of feeling your arm is there like you normally would and it's being useful, you just feel pain. And he actually, because he does a lot of physical labour in his work, he would feel pain in the days following as if he had really strained himself.
Yeah.
and done a lot of... They don't 100% understand why. I think, the nerves are still there and they're waiting for something to happen.
They're there, they're waiting for feedback.
Yeah. They have been built for all kinds of feedback and they're not getting that feedback. So they don't understand why this is. But there seems to be something with this study. It's like, because he has now some level of autonomy over his phantom limb, that he can control it. It's not just, you know, a passive thing where he's in pain and he has no control over it.
Yeah.
The pain has started to dissipate.
He says he's been experiencing unrelenting pain since 1965, which is when he actually lost the limb. And this was the first time that he's had some respite.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. When I spoke to Max, the guy behind it, and he said after week 6, he had like significant progress and now his life is relatively pain-free. I think he still experiences pain, but now he can experience stretches of time where he has no pain at all, especially right after using the AR system. And quite incredibly, one of the things he has felt for 48 years, he's felt like his fist is clenched tightly, like constantly. And because, you know, one of the movements in this was flexing your wrist and your palm, he now feels permanently like his hand is relaxed.
Wow.
Which is quite amazing.
So this, we must, you know, point out, this is just one example of this working. Like, what's the kind of plans for making this more widely available?
They're actually already beginning trials in a hospital, I believe, still in Sweden, and a couple places abroad. They're obviously really hopeful about it, but there could be, you know, this guy could just be particularly good at controlling, you know, using his thoughts to control the electrical signals in the nerves.
Yeah.
But the point is that because it's only one person, they don't know if it's to do with just literally seeing your arm move on screen when you think about it, or having that real control that he seems to have on the racing car, or a combination of these. So basically, clinical trials will hopefully... But he really thinks, the guy who's created this, that we're going to be, you know, seeing this everywhere. People have it at home and it could be used by everybody, including spinal cord injury victims.
Well, that's all of the main part of the news we've got for you this week. But we have got a lovely little segment from Nate, who is in Barcelona at Mobile World Congress, as I mentioned in the intro. And so I'm just going to hand over to Nate.
Greetings, everyone. Nate here. Yes, I'm in Barcelona for Mobile World Congress. Just thought I'd barge into the show here and give you a report on what's been hitting the headlines and my face and my eyes and my hands out at this year's show. So obvious stuff first, Samsung's Galaxy S5, that was announced. This is Samsung's new flagship Android phone, and to say it looks quite a lot like the S4 would be the understatement of the week. If you've held an S4 or seen one, you've pretty much held or seen the S5. The screen is a bit bigger though, it's 0.1 inches larger to be specific, so it's now 5.1 inches, and the resolution is the same as last time, 1920 by 1080, that's full HD. But Samsung's actually given this quite a lot more power. It's got a 2.5 gigahertz quad core processor, and it'll shoot 4K ultra HD video. The screen can't play it back, but the camera will capture it. So if at some point you buy a 4K TV, you will be able to watch all the videos in 4K that you shot on this. The phone's water resistant, so you can take it in the shower as well, or in the rain during British summers, you know how they are. And it's got a heart rate monitor built into the back for logging your heart's ticking rate. Now, I've done a report on wired.co.uk, that's no surprise there probably, and a video as well that I shot with the S5, or rather about the S5. So if you're curious, do pop over to wired.co.uk, search S5, and check out my reports. We also went hands-on with Samsung's new Gear Fit, which is a wearable fitness device that looks a lot like a kind of a chunky Nike Plus Fuel Band, albeit one with a curved AMOLED screen that also lets you read email and texts while you're working out. Pairs with a whole bunch of Samsung devices. I actually wasn't expecting to come away from Mobile World Congress with any changed view on Samsung's wearables strategy, mostly because I thought the last Gear device was a chunky, underperforming experiment at best. But I think the Gear Fit might actually be one of my highlights of this year's show, at least in the wearables category. It's definitely worth checking out. Again, I've got a report and a video on wired.co.uk if you're curious. Just search for Gear Fit. Elsewhere around the show, there are a lot of mid-sized phablets. Katie Collins, one of our esteemed writers, as many of you know, is out here with me. And between us, I think we've lost count how many times we've seen a 6-inch or a 7-inch or an 8-inch tablet and wondered, okay, is this a massive phone or a small tablet? And it's a common argument, but we've come up with a way of deciding without having to be the guy sat on the fence using the word phablet. It's such an awful word. Anyway, if there's a speaker where the phone's earpiece should be, then it's a phone, even if it's 7 inches, because we have seen a 7-inch phone with a speaker in that place. You can hold it up to your face and make a call. It looks ridiculous, but it exists. And if it doesn't have one there, then it's a tablet, even if it's only 6 inches. Problem solved. You're welcome. Now, one device we weren't expecting to see, but were pleasantly surprised that we did, was Mozilla's $25 or £15 Firefox OS-based smartphone. This is a very basic but very capable little smartphone, relatively speaking at least, aimed at growth areas, i.e. the markets of the world increasingly adopting smartphones, but at much lower price points than areas like the UK and North America, where we're happy to pay a couple of grand for a phone over the course of a 2-year contract. Now, there are billions of people not yet using smartphones at all, or even the web at all. And many of these potential connected individuals do not have the spare income to warrant a smartphone, so feature phones rule in these areas. But now smartphone tech has developed this far, the technology that we considered cutting edge just a few years ago is cheap enough to fit into a device that costs just over a tenner. And the Firefox phone in question is more powerful, actually, than the first iPhone. It's got a 1 GHz processor. So it's really exciting trend to see, I think, and to see how it's evolving. Nokia actually revealed the Nokia X line of phones too, which run Android. And it's the first time Nokia has ever made an Android phone. Again, it'll be super cheap, not as low as the Firefox one, but still very, very affordable and aimed at developing markets. I've done a hands-on with the Firefox device, and I spoke to Jonathan Nightingale, who's VP of Firefox, and have a big report about the device itself and Mozilla's vision for it on wired.co.uk. Similarly, Katie's been hands-on with the Nokia X devices that were announced here, so we've got a write-up and photos of what Nokia's up to there as well. Now, my time for this segment, I think, is ticking. I've got a few other things I was going to say, but I'll leave it for now. We've got more over at wired.co.uk, of course. If you go to wired.co.uk/MWC2014 and check out everything Katie and I have been writing and photographing and videoing, there's loads more than I could cover here. Anyway, I will see you next week. For now, I've got more future tech to write about and a plate of tapas to eat, probably in bed.
Thanks, Nate. And our final segment for this week is going to be Oh No They Didn't. Pronounce that without sounding like too much of a knob this time. I normally say, oh no, they didn't, but I always feel ridiculous. But anyway, the news this week is that the European Union and Brazil have agreed to lay a fiber optic undersea communications cable across the Atlantic. The cable, which will cost $185 million, has been designed to guarantee the neutrality of the internet and to enhance protection of communications. So the subtext, of course, is that in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations of mass surveillance, both Brazil and Europe have felt very uncomfortable with the level of control that the US has over the communications infrastructure. So did you know that at the moment there are 600 communications connections between Europe and Brazil? There's only one that connects directly. All the rest go through the US.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, so this will be number two. The reason that this has come about is obviously we've seen a lot of grumbles from lots of different countries about the NSA revelations, but Brazil itself has been talking about developing a national encrypted email system for a while so that it's protected from surveillance. Similarly, we've seen politicians in Germany and France express horror about the fact that they were tapped by the NSA, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Both Brazil and Europe argue that this is the only way to guarantee neutrality of the internet and protect freedom of expression.
I think that's what's the really worrying bit. I think when anyone ever says, oh, I can guarantee this or that,
yeah,
that's a red flag for me. I think that's a very odd thing to say.
Yeah, it is very odd to say, especially when, you know, how is that going to work when we've got our email stored on Google's servers and, exactly, you know, all our social networking on Facebook, which are in the US. So it's always going to have to go through there at some point.
Brazil actually was quite vocal about this, I think, when it came out that the leader had been, I think her phone calls were tapped as well. And she proposed that Google and Facebook and everyone had to have their servers
based
in Brazil. So that would be her way around it.
But doesn't this like tie into something that Tim Berners-Lee said when he was speaking at the launch of our magazine issue, which was the 25th anniversary of the web? It's the March issue out now. But he was talking about that this is not the right way to go, didn't
he? Yeah, that's specifically what he was afraid, well, part of what he was afraid would come out of all the NSA and GCHQ leaks. He talked about concern that of a balkanized web appearing either through to paranoia or monopolies of power.
And when you say balkanized, what do you mean by that?
Well, literally that, you know, this is my internet and you can't have it. Like national intranets like Iran's talking about. Angela Merkel actually spoke about this earlier this month. She talked about a European data network,
yeah,
which is but originally actually state-owned telecoms providers in Germany had like done this big campaign about email made in Germany, and we're kind of pushing, it seemed, yeah, for some kind of national network. So perhaps this isn't quite as bad as that because it's cross continents. But I mean, I remember a story, I think it was last year, about how Germany was massively investing in their spy agency, an extra few hundred million.
Yeah.
So it seems the revelations have basically made the world a much worse place.
Interestingly, these fiber optic cables can be hacked by US submarines anyway. There's a submarine, the Jimmy Carter submarine, can actually go down to the cable, physically to the cable itself, hook up to it, sort of download everything from it, and then swim away.
Escape the Americans.
You can't escape the NSA.
That is just such a wonderful, but ludicrous story.
It sounds like something from a James Bond film.
Yeah. Is that a fact?
That is a fact. Thing. Jimmy I'm Carter pretty sure submarine. We wrote about this.
One cable. Maybe we need to have a stealth cable covered in some kind of camouflage. Or we should get all those camouflage fish, you know, those ones that sort of look like the sand. We can get them to sort of arrange themselves around.
Oh, they'll find a way. They'll have some kind of killer dolphins on the loose. It's kind of sad. Snowden did the leaks to make the world a better place, and governments are slowly using it
to make it much worse.
Yeah.
Well, on that slightly depressing note, we're going to end the podcast. But if you have any thoughts about the idea of a Europe-only internet or the data connection between Brazil and Europe that bypasses the US, then please do email us podcast@y.co.uk. Now, we have a little bit more feedback before we wrap things up. The first point was actually, again, it was a care.data, but it relates to something we were talking about last week. We had a question from someone who asked what would happen to data for foreigners treated in UK hospitals. I actually contacted the NHS and asked them this exact question, and they replied. They said, anyone who's treated in a hospital will have their record submitted via SUS. Don't need to know what that is. So these will end up in the database. A status flag will indicate that the patient is an overseas visitor. For the GP extract, it's unlikely that a GP would register a temporary foreign visitor, and therefore they would not appear in the extract. But if they had registered the patient and they remained active on the GP record, then they would be included. So hopefully that answers your question. And the final piece of feedback we had was from Sally Kerr, who picked up on something that Nate actually said in, I think it was last week's podcast as well. And Nate said, is it scones like bones or scone like gone? And she said, well, I suppose it depends if you're eating more than one. But she also added she voted Doge with a soft G. So Nicholas, you there and Sally, go. You're
yay,
a good
Sally.
Company.
I'd like to point out, I said that first. Originally. I said it's Doge like the Doge of Venice, just like the lady last week, but you all ignored me.
Anyway, on that note, we'll say goodbye and hopefully see you next week. Bye.